Please be seated. Well, good morning. My goodness, we have a full house today. Nice to see you all here. Before we call the first case for the day, we have some students that are visiting, and my notes tell me they're from Lake Mills High School. If they are here, would they please stand and have their advisors stand? Oh my, a nice group. Thank you very much. Please be seated. The students are here on a program that we co-sponsor with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. And they learn a little bit about the case that's going to be heard today. And then at the lunchtime, if they can stay around at the lunch break, one of the justices, and today it's going to be Justice Annette Ziegler, will speak to the students and tell them a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court. She won't be talking about the substance of the case, but gives them an idea about how the Supreme Court fits together with the other courts in the state. So thank you very much for coming. All right. Our first case of the morning. Oh, but before I do that, I need to introduce the court to the students, and I just about forgot to do that, but that's part of my job. On the far right, Justice Gableman's chair sits empty. He's been delayed a little bit. He will be in momentarily. Then on the furthest side on the right is Justice David Prosser. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Chief Justice Pat Rogensack. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Ziegler. And at the far end, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Now, I think we are maybe ready to call the first case, which is Doe 56 versus Mayo Clinic. Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Very
good.
May
it please the court, counsel for the record, Eric Magnuson, on behalf of the appellants. The outcome of this case hinges on whether the court will abandon its longstanding rule in medical malpractice cases that injury may not necessarily occur at the same time as wrongful conduct, as the malpractice, and import into the medical malpractice case its ruling in BBB versus Doe. It's hard to say that many B's at once.
Try harder.
In the Doe case, the BBB Doe case, that as a matter of law, the wrongful conduct and the injury are concurrent. That rule, whatever its wisdom in clergy abuse cases, has no role in medical malpractice cases. Creating an irrebuttable presumption of immediate injury from an inappropriate or unnecessary medical treatment doesn't have the same policy basis as a clergy abuse case. A genital exam by a physician cannot be said, as a matter of law, to always be wrongful and to always cause immediate harm. And to hold that to be the law for any of us, but particularly for a minor child, is wrong. The lower courts erred in ruling as a matter of law that there was an injury at the time of the malpractice. You should reverse and remand for further proceedings. In the Paul case, this court examined at length the policy reasons behind statutes of limitations in medical malpractice cases and the consequence of embracing a rule, which it did, that there may be a disconnect between malpractice and occurrence. It was concerned, rightfully so, that that would be, as it described it, in serious tension with the legislature's pronouncement that there is a discovery rule with a 5-year statute of repose. If you're claiming delayed discovery, you can only claim it for 5 years, even if you don't discover your cause of action. Not so with an accrual rule. But this court recognized and specifically said to the legislature, there is a tension here. If you want to address it, go ahead. But we are going to adopt and continue to enforce, I should say, our accrual rule, which is wrongful conduct and harm must both occur before the statute of limitations begins to run. Now, in a series of cases, Genrich, Foget, and others, the court grappled with when does the injury occur. And the lower courts concluded, as a matter of law, that the injury occurred, that there was a physical injurious change at the time of the wrongful examination. Of course, no one can ever explain what that change is. The boys went in and came out in exactly the same physical condition. The injury they suffered, the damage that is actionable, is the severe emotional distress that befell them not during the exam. We've all had medical exams where we haven't been particularly comfortable with what was going on, but it was necessary. But it's when they realized that the examination was inappropriate. They learned that when criminal charges were filed against Dr. Vandeleup.
Counsel, you haven't made a claim under 893.55 sub 1MB, the discovery statute of limitation, which is 1 year, although I know in your reply brief you mentioned that it would be timely under that. You argue that. Why wasn't a claim made under that statute of limitation?
Your Honor, we have chosen to limit our claim to the accrual rule, not the discovery rule.
What? I'm sorry. You'll have to speak up, and you'll have to raise the podium and get closer to the microphone.
I will.
We have a repaired system, which is not maybe as good as our unrepaired system.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll speak up. I hope
good
that's
idea.
Better.
Thank you.
Your Honor, it is consistent with our claim in this case to only pursue the accrual rule. Wrongful act is severe emotional distress that arises only upon realization. It's not a delayed discovery. It's not a delayed discovery of an injury that already occurred. It is the injury itself that accrues in 2012 when they learn of the wrongful nature of the examination. Up until then, they might be slightly embarrassed. But that's not actionable. We can't sue people because we feel a little uncomfortable. Under Wisconsin law, a claim exists for severe emotional distress when the distress is severe and has physical manifestations, which is what we claim happened in 2012.
The reason I ask the question is because it strikes me that you might have a better argument under the one-year statute of limitations, because the crux of your argument is that the boys did not and could not have discovered that they were indeed injured until that later point in time, and their claim arguably was filed within that one-year period. So I guess I'm trying to get at why you chose to proceed under the three-year statute of limitation argument.
Because there's a look-back issue. The treatment of the boys took place over a number of years, and we may have a problem with having the claim extend back. If they discover within a year of the wrongful conduct, there are several repeated years of wrongful conduct. It is a better claim for my clients, frankly. And it is simply the fact, too, that they weren't injured until they learned that all those examinations were inappropriate. That's when they suffered severe emotional distress. There's not an allegation in the complaint. There's not a fact in the record that prior to 2012, they suffered actionable severe emotional distress. And that's why we pled it in that fashion.
Thank you.
That's why we make this argument.
Is there a limitation on your accrual rule?
Your Honor, in Paul versus Skemp at page 874 of the opinion, the court talked about the fact that there may, in fact, be no limitation on it. It said that that is in tension with the discovery rule and in tension with the 5-year statute of repose under the discovery statute. It will be a factual limitation, but not a legal limitation. And there may be some point in time where the conduct is so remote from the harm that it can't be tied together factually. But you specifically talked about that, as I said, at page 874 of the opinion. And you said, it's the accrual rule that we have had going back to, I think, Merkel in 1989.
So that the 5 years is not controlling on anything in your theory?
It is not. You specifically said that in the Paul case. You said that the five-year statute of repose does not apply to an accrual theory. And that's the theory that we are pursuing here. Another reason that we have chosen, besides the fact that it's the facts, but that's our argument.
Part of what concerns me now, listening to your answers to the last two questions, part of what concerns me is, will there be any limitation ever to being able to bring this kind of a claim? It seems to really throw all the limitations out the window, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, as I said, you talked about that in Paul and said it's a concern. The legislature certainly could address it, but there will be a factual and proof limitation at some point in time, and latches may be a defense at some point in time. But purely from the statute of limitations issue, and remember, statutes of limitations are legislatively created limits on claims. If the legislature had wanted to put a statute of repose on accrual claims, it could have done that. But again, I would urge the court to look at page 870 and 874 of the Paul opinion, where you wrestle with this very question.
What paragraph? Do you know what paragraph you're talking about?
I don't, Your Honor. I apologize for that. I might be able to find it when I sit down, but the copy of the case I have printed out doesn't have the paragraph.
I was impressed with the page number.
Can I just have a brief follow-up on that?
Yes.
So, for example, if I had a claim that was outside the statute of limitation, but then I had severe emotional distress that occurred later, I could then bring the claim under that basis.
Not as you phrased that question, Your Honor, because your predicate was, if I had a claim and then had severe emotional distress.
You left scissors in me.
No, because at that point in time, the severe emotional distress is simply another item of damage. And your case law is quite clear. Additional damages suffered at a later date don't start the statute of limitations running again. But that is not our claim. They had no actionable damages at the time of the examination because it was the wrongful nature of it, the discovery of that, when memory met realization that they suffered the severe emotional distress. And that's the only injury they're claiming.
That's what I need your help with. How do we know when it's an element of damages with the original claim versus an element of damages for a new tort claim?
I think you ask first, what is the first tort claim? What do they have? They have wrongful conduct, but they don't have any damages initially. They don't have damages in the context of this case because they don't understand that there has been a violation of the standard of care. They think they're supposed to be examined in this way. They are not damaged to the point where it is actionable. You can't bring a lawsuit because I was uncomfortable. It is an element of damage. It's like a broken leg. It's like a cut. It is severe emotional distress. That is a cause of action that you can bring in Wisconsin under Wisconsin law. But you have to prove the elements of that. Now, if that is the only item of damage you seek, that's when your claim accrues. If it flows from a prior injury, no matter how small, you get a cut. You don't realize that it's going to leave you with a hideous scar. You have the cut. It's the result of negligence. Your claim accrues at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But 20 years later, it has become puckered and twisted, and you feel really upset about it. You suffer severe emotional distress. That's additional damage. But what the defendants it's additional damage for the first claim, and it does not start the statute running anew. But if there's no injury from the wrongful conduct until the wrongfulness is realized, that is, you don't have severe emotional distress until the misconduct causes it, and in this case it causes it upon realization, then you have no claim. It accrues at the time you begin to suffer the severe emotional distress. And as I was pointing out, the defendants, the lower courts, nobody was able to say, here's the physical injury. Here's the injury that would support a lawsuit a medical malpractice lawsuit at the time of the examination. There isn't one. There isn't one until they, because nothing's physically changed. Genrich, you leave a sponge inside somebody. That's a physical injurious change. The statute starts to run. If you, on the other hand, in the tubal ligation case, in the not diagnosing the venous malformation case, there's wrongful conduct, but there is no injury until a later date. And that's all we're saying here. Now,
counsel,
that's a fact issue, Your Honor.
Judge Conley in the Western District in a case didn't buy your argument. How do you constructively criticize his? I assume you don't agree with his opinion.
I do not, Your Honor.
Right. So how do you get around what, on the face of it, looks like a very intelligent, an analytical approach to these various cases that we have? He went right through them all.
Right. And I think that he would say, I'm bound to follow the law of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, the Supreme Court apparently has said, as a matter of law, when there is an inappropriate contact by an adult with the genitals of a minor, that's harm there, and the cause of action accrues.
Well,
that's
is that
wrong.
The law? Shouldn't we follow it?
Well, Your Honor, you can follow it in the clergy abuse cases, the context in which you made that decision, but you should not follow it in the medical malpractice.
So you
because
think, you think he erred because that's not the law of Wisconsin, as you
well,
understand it.
I'm not arguing to the Seventh Circuit. I'm arguing to you, and you declare the law here.
I understand that, but when you got a well-written opinion that goes through these cases and analyzes them, there's a strong feeling here that, I shouldn't talk for my colleagues, but on the basis of past experience, that it's your job to get rid of that in some manner.
You should always be guided by thoughtful decisions of other judges.
So what's not thoughtful here?
Oh, I didn't say it wasn't thoughtful. It's just wrong.
Okay. What's wrong here? I'll buy either one of these.
It's wrong because, like all the other judges who have looked at this, he fails to recognize that the injury, the damages, occurred not concurrent with the wrongful conduct. And he adopts the same physical injurious change at the time of the wrongful touching. And with respect, there are no facts pleaded in this case. There are no facts proven in this case to show that there was any injury at the time of the genital examination. None. Zero. It is the factual claim of the plaintiffs, not their legal conclusion. It is their factual claim that several years later, when they learned of the wrongful nature of the conduct, they suffered severe emotional distress. Now, we could lose that case at trial, but we're not at trial. We are on a motion to dismiss. We have to accept the allegations of the plaintiffs as true. And if the allegation is no injury here, injury here, cause of action accrues when there's both wrongful conduct and injury, that survives a motion to dismiss. And that is the analytical error that Judge Connolly and the other judges have made. They have felt constrained by what you said in BBB Doe, that it is as a matter of law an irrebuttable presumption that there is harm and it's realized at the time of the wrongful conduct. You can say that about clergy, you can say it about Boy Scout leaders, but you cannot say it about a physician conducting a genital exam of anyone, much less a minor.
Because you expect the physician to touch all parts of the body, whereas you don't expect either the priest or the Boy Scout leader to do that. Isn't
absolutely,
that your point?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, how do you react to the argument that, look, the legislature has in a variety of statutes, in effect, closing down the period of the statute of limitations.
In medical malpractice cases in particular.
And across the board.
I think
they are shortening up the statute of limitations, and by statutes of repose, by other statutes, and in medical malpractice. I mean, the whole thing is to discourage these complaints. And one way of discouraging them is making them not timely. And yet you're asking this court to go in the other direction.
Not asking you to go in the other direction. I'm asking you to apply the statutes as they are written.
Plain text argument.
Plain text. Accrual. Historical jurisprudence of this court. Accrual of a cause of action requires both wrongful conduct and injury. Merkel, 1989, on the books for a long time. You said in this in Paul. However, the timeliness of an action filed within 3 years of the date of the injury, but more than 5 years after the negligent act or omission, is not before us. The action at issue here was filed less than 5 years. We nonetheless point out the possible conflict between actions that arise under the injury rule of accrual and the discovery rule of accrual. In pointing out this potential conflict, we urge the legislature to provide guidance by resolving it. They haven't done it. You said, okay, here's what the law says. This is how we're going to apply it. And if there's a problem with that, the legislature may feel free to step in, as it does. That's its job, but it hasn't. And so our position before you today is a simple and straightforward one. The accrual rule under the medical malpractice statute of limitations does not begin to run until there is both wrongful conduct and actionable harm. When the actionable harm is simply emotional distress, and I don't mean to diminish that in any way, there must be severe emotional distress for a cause of action under Wisconsin law. The factual allegation in this complaint is that that did not occur until they learned of the wrongful nature. You can test that by summary judgment later. You can test it at trial. But you cannot say as a matter of law that fails to state a claim.
So if this doctor, I know this sounds silly, but it depends what kind of doctor you are then, in light of what you had just answered to Justice Abramson. Because if it were an eye doctor, then this would accrue at the time of the act, right? It's that this doctor could be expected to touch all parts of your body where an eye doctor who did this wouldn't be.
I understand the court's looking for more limiting principles.
I'm trying to figure it out. That's all.
Yeah.
I mean,
it could be. I mean, the JW case is a good example. Someone goes in for a physical and the doctor conducts a rectal and prostate exam. And that's not what they were there for. This court nonetheless said, or I'm sorry, the Court of Appeals said that's a medical malpractice claim. Now the accrual, I mean, they knew right away what had happened to them. These were adults to whom it happened. And it may be that there is some circumstance where the accrual will take place concurrent with the inappropriate conduct by the physician. But this is a very specific case. This is a genital exam that is supposed to take place. It is done in a way that violates the standard of care of medical malpractice. And that makes it wrongful, and the wrongful nature of it causes emotional distress, not at the time because they think it's supposed to be okay, but when they learn of the violation. And it is a unique case, but it is a factually sufficient case. It's a legally sufficient case.
It seems you're focusing a lot, as you should be, on the harm. But at the cause of the harm, the time of the examination was either conducted in a medically proper way or it was not. It was done in a way that was wrong. It seems to me, one of the challenges I'm having with your position is, it seems to me that if we adopt your theory, then the court would be setting a rule that leaves it to chance or happenstance. What if these other prosecutions had never taken place? And how is it that we should write, what is the rule What is the rule? And I have Genrich in mind, the sponge. Right. What is the rule that you would like to see emerge from this case? Of course, every member of this bench cares deeply about the people involved in this case, but we have an obligation to take a rule that will be applied to subsequent cases. What is the rule you are asking us for?
Your Honor, I'm not asking you for any new rule, first of all.
Okay.
I'm asking you to apply the rule that you enunciated in Paul versus Skimp, where you said our jurisprudence has for decades recognized there must be the wrongful conduct and the injury, and the claim doesn't accrue until that happens, and that may cause delay beyond what the legislature has deemed reasonable in other contexts, but those statutes don't apply here. I'm asking you to say that is the law in this case because it was the law there and it was the law in other cases.
So not to belabor the issue, but it was in 2012 when the other charges came to light that your clients realized. Go ahead.
When my clients suffered the severe emotional distress.
And they suffered it because of the awareness that others had come forward to make allegations against the doctor.
They suffered it because they were aware at that point that the exam that they thought was completely normal, that their parents said, you've got to go through.
Now that's where I want to bury it.
Violated.
And that's the assumption that's made throughout.
It's not an assumption, Your Honor, if I might. I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm very cognizant of my time.
Well, and I'm very cognizant that, like Justice Ziegler, I am trying to find out what the best answer is.
Your Honor, it's a fact. It's not a legal claim. When the injury occurred, it is a question of fact. When did they first suffer severe emotional distress? Because, as I have said, that's the actual
Well, your claim, you interrupted me, so I'm going to interrupt you. That's all right. Your claim, though, it seems to me, I didn't see in the writings or the briefs any kind of ambiguity about, well, maybe it accrued. You are taking the position, correct me if I'm wrong, you're taking the position that when the victims learned of the other charges, that is when the harm to your clients occurred.
Madam Chief Justice, my red light is on.
Yes,
answer.
Please answer the question.
Your Honor, that is when actionable harm occurred. And actionable harm under Wisconsin law is severe emotional distress. It is not mere annoyance. It's not petty embarrassment. Yes, that is our claim. And it's no different than what if the woman in the Fojit case, I think I've got that right, had become pregnant 7 years later after the failed tubal ligation. No problem. Under the law, as you have announced it, that claim goes forward. Now, that may need legislative action, but we're dealing with the statutes as they are written now.
Okay. Thank you for helping me to understand your position.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Please.
Thank you. My name is Samuel Lieb, and I represent Dr. Vandeloup.
Could I follow up just so I can get beyond this and completely listen to your side of it? What I hear counsel saying is that this claim accrues when the plaintiffs learned that this doctor was charged with a crime.
You are toiling with this case, as I have,
okay,
for a long time.
So then are the damages, I was looking at the complaint and the plea for relief, and I'm trying to figure out, are the damages then tethered to the harm caused by the criminal charges coming to light versus the underlying medical malpractice? Those are distinct things, and
yes.
Counsel's red light came on before I had a chance to ask him again, so I'm hoping when he gets up he's going to help me with that. Because I'm trying to figure out, if I were the judge in this case, how would I instruct the jury on the damages that flow from this claim from a relief? It's almost like the DA should be charged I mean, a party to this lawsuit, because the DA, if the DA would have never brought the charges, these people would have never been harmed under this theory. So I'm trying to figure it out. What are the damages that flow from this claim that is accrued because criminal charges have occurred? So I'm sort of asking counsel who's sitting down now the same question, because I need help with that. If I were to instruct the jury, what is my instruction so that we don't open up damages to everything that would have been available under a traditional malpractice claim? Because this may very well be a viable claim. So I need you to help me with that.
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for asking the question, because that's why this case has a sense of like nailing jello to a tree. What you've got is an event that takes place remotely as to somebody else, and in fact dealing with the intent, because that's what the criminal charge was, an intent crime. And what essentially they're saying is that that somehow can be the actual and proximate cause component of a touching, which they have to have, that took place at the time of the last appointment. That is the confounding nature of what they're trying to say, because essentially what they're saying is there's a new cause of action. And it's a new concept in the law that when the malpractice, where you need negligence, actual cause, proximate cause, and damages, that's the accrual of a malpractice claim, and that could only be tethered to the touching, because that's the offensive conduct they're talking about. If you bring in this concept, I heard that my doctor was arrested, that can't be causal of the injury. They're talking about, this is why, Justice Bradley, they can't use the one-year component, because what they're claiming is that in 1 year, it created a claim, not discovered a claim. That's the discovery statute. They would have to admit that the accrual took place, which I would contend did take place. There is a harm. There is a harm. The harm took place at the time of the touching. In fact, their claim regarding the harm still persists. It is the intentional tort claim that still persists in front of Judge Shoemaker. The seriousness of barring an adolescent from the courts based upon this kind of claim is not lost on me. It's not lost on my client. It was not lost on Judge Shoemaker. Judge Shoemaker presided over the criminal case where my client was exonerated. He dismissed the malpractice claim. Judge Connolly dismissed the malpractice claim, and Judge Connolly didn't need BBB Doe to do that. It was the Jenrich case that grounded the dismissal by Judge Connolly. That was his reasoning, and he used the JWBB case as a component of that. But when this case was heard by the Court of Appeals, it wasn't lost on them either. But the wrong that you're toiling with and the remedy for that wrong still persists in the trial court. We're here to talk about the malpractice claim, and that accrued on the date of the touching.
Your opposing counsel cites to the Paul case, the Paul case references a couple of times, I'm referring to paragraph 34 and page 530, as our long-time precedent has established, the negligence and its result in injury should be considered separately. And it goes on to say the negligence must cause an injury before there's an accrual of a claim. So that has been our jurisprudence. I'll set BBE Doe aside. BBE Doe was 1997, Paul is 2001. That's my understanding of the law as we set forth in Paul versus Kemp. That has been our precedent. There is a tension, as recognized in Paul, but I don't understand why you're suggesting that the fact of injury as a matter of law has to be at the same time as the wrongful conduct. That seems inconsistent.
And this is the plaintiff appellant has tended to posture this in the BBB Doe context. We don't need BBB Doe.
Okay, let's stay with Paul versus Genrich.
And Genrich both cited to and accommodated Foget and Paul. And the Genrich case concluded that when there's physically injurious change, that cause of action accrues. And dovetailing with the Paul case, there is actionable injury occurs when negligence causes a greater harm than that which existed at the time of the negligent act. In that case, Paul dealt with a brain malformation and a rupture. And they said in that case the misdiagnosis wasn't synonymous with the injury. There was a change in these adolescents. The change in the adolescents at the time of the touching, it's the physical touching. It's the physical contact. It's a sensation. They don't have repressed memories. That's not part of this claim. They never forgot this conduct. That's not part of this claim. They remember it. And the memory is the harm. The memory is the harm. And that endured, unlike these other cases, like the Archdiocese cases, where we were dealing with issues of repressed memory or forgotten memory, or the Pretzlaff case. What you're dealing with in this case is a physical contact, a physical harm.
But, counsel, your opposing counsel would say, okay, that's all true, fair enough, but once his clients learned of the criminal charges, that placed their memories in context where they were able then to perceive the conduct that occurred during the medical exam in a way that made them realize they had been harmed, thereby creating a new distinct injury, if I follow the argument.
That's what they're saying, and that's why it's so hard to accept, because if you were to accept their position, then nobody would ever have a medical malpractice claim with the kind of touching that they're claiming unless something else happened. And the something else would be advising that a criminal conduct took place or an arrest took place as relates to somebody else.
I'm not sure that's true, because with the age of the individuals that we're talking about, young boys, from something like 8 years old to 15, the two of them, right?
Yes, 14 and 15 at the time of the last contact.
Right, and one started when he was 8 and one started when he was 9 or something. But my point is this. It is at least a question of fact whether kids of that age are going to understand or realize at the time of the occurrence that something is wrong, that they are being treated wrongfully. And so why shouldn't it be? What is your direct response to the idea that they can realize? Not everybody would need that context. People perhaps of older vintage would realize something was amiss at the time of the exam, perhaps. But what is wrong with the idea of saying, gee, someone who didn't have the mental capacity to understand that they were being harmed at the time of the examination can, based on subsequent events and the revelation of subsequent wrongdoing, based on that realization within the context that we're talking about here, that couldn't have that gestalt or aha moment of, oh, that was wrong. I was a victim. I was victimized. What's wrong with that in this context?
Well, it is a question of law, what we're dealing with, because the material facts are not in dispute. The examination that were performed on the child was not in dispute. And by their own admission, the appellants are claiming it's this criminal arrest related to somebody else that somehow completes a claim, and it just can't be so.
And does that go back to what you said a few minutes ago in response to another question from the bench, that there is an underlying, that the underlying torts claim for the actual event of the examinations is still in Eau Claire County?
The intentional, yes,
and
the claim of intentional tort.
And that, what's the status of that?
That's pending in front of the court.
Okay. Did Judge Schumacher put a hold on it or something until resolution of this case?
No, actually not. There is no statute of limitations argument as to that because, and this is what the legislature accommodated. The legislature accommodated that in these circumstances, a child would have until the age of 35 to bring that type of claim. That's 893, 595, I think it was. I may be wrong about the statute number, but this is a part of the legislative concept.
Chief Justice,
yes,
I understand the red light is on. May I ask one more question?
Yes, please. And I don't think you finished the answer either.
It was 893-587. I apologize for
that.
But 893-587 is what preserves their alleged wrong and their remedy. And that persists in the court. What we're talking about is the malpractice action. And that accrued at the time of the touching and is barred by the three-year statute.
Okay.
Mr. Lieb, you're asking this court to hold as a matter of law that the negligence and injury occurred at the examination.
A part of the injury, Your Honor, and that's all that's necessary.
Right. But it seems to me that that's a question for the jury. Did they occur at the same time, or did they not? You want this court to say, as a matter of law, that's what happened in this case. But it need not be. And in different fact situations, it could be different. You just want us to say that, hey, just because he had a criminal trial and then brought it to the public attention and the plaintiff's attention, it's not good enough. Right? And I want to question why, and maybe this is another way of saying what Justice Gableman was getting at, that this is a question for the jury in this particular case.
I don't believe so. I think it is a matter of law because there is no question of material fact. And the only thing they want to inject is an intent of the actor at some later date. And the law is clear that in malpractice and negligence as a whole, mens rea or an intent factor is irrelevant. That's what the court held. And
Just because there's no dispute of fact doesn't mean that you don't have a jury issue on the, I'll take one element, causation, or another element of negligence, that it still goes to a jury, even though there's no dispute of fact. That as a matter of law, the court doesn't decide it.
In the BBB Doe case, that's not a malpractice case, Your Honor, but the court did not believe that that was a matter for a jury in that case. I believe that this case, it is not a matter for the jury. The intentional tort claim that persists is a matter for the jury. As was held by the Court of Appeals, there was a presumption that the injury was at the time of the touching and the claims accrued as of the last touch. And I would suggest that that's the only way it can be, or there will never be a time certain.
Thank you, counsel. The BBB Doe was an archdiocese case controlled by Pritzlaff. The court has moved somewhat from that, those two issues, those two cases.
Justice Bradley, I believe, has another question before you sit down, but please.
What is the physical injurious change here?
These adolescents were different after the touching than they were before.
Where's the evidence that they were different? What was changed? Explain to me how the physical injurious change was manifested in a difference.
Okay. This is where this case is different from Genrich. Genrich was a sponge, and this is not a sponge. There were no marks or bruises left. The injury is the touching.
You need a physical injurious change? I mean, yes. I thought that was part of our law. Okay.
Yes,
so
it is.
Describe for me the physical injurious change and why you describe it for me, because I don't see it. I need help with that.
Okay. The physically injurious change is these were adolescents that were not touched in that way that they're claiming is offensive now before this time. It's the touching. It is the sensation. That's all physical. But if there is no physical sensational change, then they have no claim anyways. It doesn't exist because you can't use an arrest of a doctor. Every patient would have a claim. Whether they examine the ear or the foot, it doesn't matter.
What you need is then you need severe emotional distress, right? I mean, isn't that the injury? Our jury instructions 15-11 describe the injury of severe emotional distress and what you have to show in order to get it. I mean, that's an injury. It's recognized in our jury instructions.
No, for the tort claim, you do not need that. That's part of their other problem, because this is all part and parcel of their intentional claim. And you can't...
Well, this says negligence.
Yes.
I mean, there's 1511 isn't an intentional, it's a negligent, and has severe emotional distress. The law permits a claim for emotional distress separate from physical injuries or in the absence of physical injuries only when the emotional distress is so severe that no reasonable person could be expected to endure it. And that's what our case law, our jury instructions, based on the case law state.
Well, on basic malpractice law, you can get emotional distress. They could have gotten emotional distress on the day of the last examination or the next day or the next day. They could have gotten their emotional distress. The fact that it is, it goes back to the touching. It is the touching that is offensive to them. They never forgot it. They never repressed it.
The touching is the wrongful conduct. Now we're talking about the injury. What's the injury and when did it occur?
The touching is the injury. It's a physically injurious change because this is the tactile event. It didn't leave a mark, that's true. But it is the touching. It's the physicality of the touching that is injurious to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Guy DeBoe, and I'm here today on behalf of the Mayo Clinic Health System.
Mr. DeBoe, you'll have to talk into the microphone.
Okay. Is this a little better?
Much better, so
all
lean
right.
In.
All right, I will do my best, Your Honor. Thank you. Mr. Lieb spoke about the claim against his client, which is solely a medical malpractice claim. We're here today because there's a lot more in that complaint than just a medical malpractice claim. There are allegations of sexual battery that were levied against Dr. Vandeleau, and there are claims that are derivative of those allegations of sexual battery. Those are different legal theories based on essentially the same underlying conduct. But I'd like to emphasize something that is both one simple and I think fairly profound to our understanding of what's going on here, and that is the plaintiff is certainly allowed to plead alternative legal theories. But these theories are not just alternative, they are mutually exclusive. And our case law has established that. If a physician sexually batters a patient that is not the provision of medical care, it is not a medical malpractice claim. They have one or the other, and they can make either interpretation they wish. That's the beauty of pleading alternative theories. But what they are not allowed to do is to confound those theories. And so much of what we have heard in the briefing, in the arguments today, and I think to a certain extent, I don't want the court to buy into it, but in some of the questions that are forthcoming, is a conflation of those two concepts. We've been hearing words like wrongful. We've been hearing words like improper, inappropriate. Those are not legal terms. But they are used to confound these two concepts in a way, and I will perhaps get to something that some of the questions being asked earlier. This happens in a very profound way. We are saying that medical malpractice damages arise out of the knowledge of criminal conduct. That is something that has never been recognized in Wisconsin at all. But it comes into existence because the arguments are saying, oh, well, they realized that the conduct was inappropriate. No, they didn't. They may have thought that the conduct that they were subject to was criminal when they heard that criminal charges were brought against them. That claim survives. Nobody said, oh, look, Dr. Vandeleu was accused of medical malpractice, therefore he must have committed medical malpractice on me. It is a logical non sequitur to connect those two things together, and I would suggest that it is not a plausible connection to be drawn here.
I don't think it is a logical non sequitur, so challenge me on this. I mean, I may be wrong.
Okay.
I see, I live in Wausau, yesterday's newspaper, 92-year-old grandfather, charged and convicted, actually, of sexually abusing his, I think, his grandkids for over the years. You know, when you're 8 or 9 years old, it isn't a matter of being illogical or non sequitur. You know, you sometimes don't know, or 10 years old, or 11 years old, or 20 years old, or 30 years old, but especially when you're younger, you don't have it all together. You don't know that it's conduct necessarily. Now, some, it's a matter of degree. You know, some is clearly, is more obvious. But a lot of it is gray. A lot of life is gray. And a lot of conduct that is perpetrated upon 8 and 9 and 10-year-olds is gray. Some is black and white, but a lot of it's gray. So how can you make such a statement that it's a logical non sequitur, that when someone finally brings it to attention that this is what's going on with Grandpa, oh yeah, well, that happened to me too, and I always thought there was something
and
wrong.
And I believe what Your Honor is talking about is allegations of sexual assault. And the legislature has addressed that because sexual assault of a child allows that individual to bring a claim until they're 35 years of age.
What I'm talking about is your statement that it's a illogical and a non sequitur, and that
doesn't comport
with my life experience as a circuit court judge or as a Supreme Court.
I think it is a non sequitur in this context, Your Honor. If, for instance, I have an interaction with my physician and I'm curious that the advice doesn't seem right, and then I later learn that my physician has been arrested for public intoxication, do I draw the context that, oh my goodness, my physician must have been intoxicated while talking to me and it doesn't make sense? No. That, you know, I who knows, I may have that belief, but if I didn't have that belief to start with, it cannot spring into existence. Now, to address the question regarding the ages of the children, now, the dates of accrual that we are looking at, the plaintiffs in this case were 14 and 15 years old. Those are the dates of accrual that are issued before the court right now. And I think that pubescent boys do have some understanding of sexual contact. We've certainly got to that in the BBB Doe case, saying that in that case, even plaintiffs as young as 8, 9 years old were presumed to understand that the conduct was wrong. But here's the thing. One of three things can actually happen in a context like that where you go to see a physician. One, you're touched, your genitals are touched, whatever examination, and you can be quite certain that nothing inappropriate happened. You can point to no conduct that was a degradation, there's no arousal by the physician. You're convinced that conduct was perfectly appropriate. That's one alternative. A second alternative is that you know that I've just been assaulted. My goodness, I need to do something. And the third possibility is that you are not sure. Those are the only three things that can possibly happen. If it is that first category, then you do not have a claim. If it is either of those second categories, you either knew or you should have known. The Court of Appeals said over 20 years ago that even in dealing with physicians, that individuals cannot turn a blind eye based on trust or belief in that physician to not question that. And that goes back to some of the policy arguments that are underlying the BBB Doe case. We want these claims to be brought forward. We don't want stale claims. We don't want open-ended claims. But I'm going to be bold here, and I'm going to suggest a new policy that I have not heard this court recognize as of yet, but I think it's something that's very consistent with the evolving nature of our societal understanding of sexual assault. And I think that this is potentially important. You know, once upon a time, there was shame cast upon those who were victims of sexual assault. And we now know that that is completely wrong. Anybody who's been sexually assaulted, it's not their fault. And what we want is a policy that lets people know it's not their fault, and we want a policy that encourages them to bring those claims forward. So if you think that you may have been the victim of sexual assault, we want every policy in place that says, bring that claim forward, bring that forward as soon as humanly possible, because if there's someone out there perpetrating that type of heinous behavior on other individuals, we want that person identified and removed from society. So in a very real way, the enforcement of statute of limitations helps us arrive at that message that needs to be delivered to society, that if you think you have been a victim, it is fine for you to come forward and understand that.
Mr. Zabot,
yes,
please.
Thank you. How does your argument play out with this fact situation that happened in central Wisconsin? Not only the 92-year-old, a doctor in central Wisconsin was sexually assaulting women while they were unconscious. They were drugged and unconscious. And they didn't realize the sexual assault, according to the newspapers, until it was brought out quite a bit later, because they were unconscious, that this is what he was doing. How does that play out, your argument play out about, you know, in the non sequiturs and illogical? And there might be situations where people have no idea that was...
If it were to be cast as a medical malpractice claim, which under the factual scenario that you presented, I don't think it can be. I still believe that it's a sexual assault. But under the scenario that you have posited, the legislature has addressed that. There's a concealment statute. And if a physician actively conceals their conduct from a patient or their wrongful conduct from a patient, then they lose the benefit of the statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm. What statute is that, do you know?
That's a great question. I would have to follow up with the court on that, but it is part
I'll
of
check it out.
It's part of 89355, I believe.
Counsel,
yes.
When Mr. Lieb argued to us, he said the injury was the memory, and the memory of it arose as soon as the touching occurred, and the memory continued on. So if I understand his argument, the date of the injury coincides with the date of the wrongful touching, because as soon as they were touched, they felt bad about it. One boy reported it and was crying when he was telling, I think, his stepfather about it. And that injury persists. So we're not in a repressed memory situation, which we've had those kind of claims that have come before the court. Why shouldn't we just focus on that and say, once the memory is there, it's the memory that gives them the shame, why isn't the memory the injury?
Oh, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that that makes perfect sense. I think that...
Well, I was getting a different take from what you were saying in response to Justice Bradley's question, so you basically agree with him, that it is the memory of the wrongful touching that is the injury.
Yes, and certainly in this case that's correct. And I think, and I'm sorry if I was unclear, one of the things, if there's anything that I do wish to make sure that this court does, is to do exactly what Judge Schumacher did, what the Court of Appeals did, what Judge Connolly did, and that is to treat these claims separately under the different scenarios, because there are some claims that are governed by 893.55, and there are some claims that are governed by 893.54, the regular tort statute. So the distinction I was drawing there was that. But no, I believe Mr. Lieb was absolutely correct on that. And there is another thing that I want to make clear, because there have been questions coming from the bench and comments that say, isn't this a factual issue? With the greatest respect, no. I believe the court's already decided that. If you look at the Gingrich case, I believe it's in footnote 6 of that case, you're very clear that injury, in this case, we're interpreting a statute. Injury is a word used in 893.55. And because you're interpreting the word injury, that is an interpretation of law. So it is a question of law when the injury occurred for accrual purposes. And again, I would direct you to note 6 of Gingrich for that. I would also point out that Gingrich was fairly clear, and this is a quote from paragraph 19, that the cause of action is going to accrue on the date of the action, quote, which eventually caused the harm. Okay? And in that case, it is very much the case that really, I think, with rare exception, that you're going to find this delayed injury after an event. And so with respect to the 893.55 arguments, the statute of limitations for medical malpractice arguments, Mr. Lieb's absolutely right. It is a but-for test. But for the fact that they were touched, they would have no claim. That's the essence of it. Oh, my gosh, I was touched by a physician, and I didn't like the way that happened. If there's not a touching, if there's not the cognitive memory of that physical tactile experience, there is no claim here. So,
Mr. DeBoe, I'd like to go back to an analogy that you made earlier, about 10 minutes ago, and you made a passing reference to it, and I want to explore a little bit the point you were trying to make. And you said, okay, say I went to my physician, and I was, you know, part of the examination includes physical touching, and I didn't think too much about it at the time, or even if I had doubts about it at the time, I didn't dwell on it. But later on, I learned that my physician is arrested for public intoxication. That was the hypothetical that you put forward to us. Now, I think you were getting close to a part that I'm struggling with here, which is, okay, let's tighten that hypothetical up a little bit. Let's bring it to the facts of this case. Is it per se? Is it a matter of night following day that if my treating physician is subsequently arrested for some kind of wrongdoing, that automatically, are we going to have to, if we accept your opposing counsel's theory of this, are we going to have to say that any time a physician is arrested on suspicion of wrongdoing, that can spark the thought that, well, that same wrongdoing, even though he enjoys the presumption of innocence, that same wrongdoing must have occurred to me because I saw that physician under similar circumstances that are being reported in the media, which, as we all know, are not always accurate.
I think that that's exactly accurate, Your Honor. That is opening the door to a whole new class of claims that all of a sudden I'm going to be able to claim that I've suffered emotional damage because someone with whom I've interacted went and did something bad with somebody else.
Because it almost seems to me, and I'm willing, and I know your opposing counsel has rebuttal time, and I'd like to hear it, it almost seems to me as if we'd have to have the trial first on the subsequently alleged bad conduct to determine whether that's truthful in order to determine whether the reporter has a solid basis for a separate claim based on an injurious act occurring when they learned about the subsequent bad act.
Well, I think that's right, and that's one of the confounding aspects of this, is that did occur, and Dr. Vandeleu was exonerated. So now our plaintiff's saying, gosh, I didn't suffer an injury because turns out he was wrongly accused.
So how does that fit in? How does that fit in with the analysis? If you were writing this opinion, how would you use that as part of your analysis, this hypothetical that we, you and I have just been discussing and you and I have been agreeing? Boy, there's interesting questions there. How would you use it?
Well, I think that I would use it in this fashion. So, you know, plaintiff's argument requires us to recognize the cause of action that has never been recognized in Wisconsin, that has no reasonable or just stopping point as to its breadth, and relies essentially entirely on the subjective beliefs of the patient. That is something that this court refuses to do because, one, in the medical malpractice context, medical malpractice claims are creatures of statute. That is not something that Chapter 655 recognizes that I'm aware of. And I'm not even sure how you could conceivably hammer that into a Chapter 655 claim. So I think that if I got to write the opinion, that would be the approach that I would take. So,
counsel, it's not entirely clear to me if the boys had immediately gone to the district attorney's office, what would the charge have been?
I presume if they'd gone to the district attorney's office, they would have been accusing the physician of sexual battery, which some boys did. And these boys have brought that claim forward, and that claim still exists. And that really is, I think, kind of bottom line here, what's going on, is that when they talk about severe emotional damage, what they're really talking about is, I want to make a claim for having been sexually abused. And guess what? They still can. That claim survives. The legislature has made sure that that claim survives. The rest of these other arguments, whether it be, you know, trying to hammer it into a medical malpractice claim against Dr. Vandeleu, trying to hammer it into a negligence claim against the clinic, you know, those don't necessarily make sense, and they are appropriately barred by statute's limitations, a decision that the legislature has made. So,
thank you.
Okay. I see that my red light is on, so
thank you.
Members of the court, the only claim we bring before you today is for medical malpractice. A medical malpractice claim requires showing of a failure to meet the standard of care and actionable injury. It isn't the criminal charges that caused the harm. That is, with due respect to my colleagues, completely misleading. It is the fact that they suffered severe emotional distress that completes their cause of action, wrongful conduct, malpractice, and damage. And without that damage, I might just finish my sentence, then I'll answer your question. Without that damage, they can't bring a lawsuit. And so it is not, the memory isn't the injury, it's 1511. The law permits a claim for emotional distress separate from physical injuries only when the emotional distress is so severe no reasonable person could endure it. When did that happen? That's the fact question. That's the limiting principle. It happened when they learned. Learning didn't cause it. Learning triggered the realization that they'd been harmed.
Okay, so what's the difference between the damages for a traditional medical malpractice claim? What would your damages be if they would have brought the claim right away versus the damages that you seek for the claim being triggered later? The damage doesn't occur till later, under your theory. So how does a jury know to not award damages for the underlying conduct, but instead just award damages for what happened after the triggering event?
You have to have an instruction on damages. In a medical malpractice claim, you may recover for, and there's a traditional instruction here, you may recover expenses. They don't claim they had any.
Right,
you may recover emotional distress damages. The emotional distress damages, which are not accompanied by a physical injury, are recoverable only if they are so severe that no reasonable person...
Yeah, and they only start when the criminal complaint
precisely
occurred.
right?
That's the only damage that they could recover.
So there are no damages. It'd be irrelevant to discuss, really, the underlying conduct.
The
only relevant conduct is what happened to them after the charge. What they faced after the charge and what they endured after the charge and the damages they get after the charge, right, under your theory?
Right. The pregnancy in Fojit wasn't the cause of the harm. The malpractice was the cause of the harm. Here, the emotional distress was triggered by the knowledge, but the knowledge wasn't the cause. It was the wrongful conduct.
So the jury would be instructed not to award any of the traditional medical malpractice damages. The jury would be instructed only to award damages as a result of their feelings after the charge.
There's severe emotional distress. I want to make that absolutely clear.
I understand that, but that occurred after the charge. So anything pre-charge would be...
No, it occurred when it occurred, Your Honor. Now, in this case, it is the
factual... That almost sounds like you want it both ways.
No,
that almost sounds like it occurred before.
No, it
and
didn't.
And I want damages before, but it occurred at the charge, and so I want damages after. That's what I'm struggling with here. I need your help. Why, if I'm the trial court judge and I buy your argument, how do I instruct the jury so that I know what the jury awards is not the traditional medical malpractice damages that you would get if you brought it right away. Would be the damages that are a result only of the emotional harm caused after the charges, the criminal charges occurred.
Your Honor, you keep saying traditional medical malpractice damages. What are they?
Well, I think you'd be able to get a lot of things. I mean, it would open it up to a lot of things if they would have gone home, told their parents, and filed a claim against the clinic, against the doctor. And then damages change over time. That's why a lot of times you can't try a case right away. You got to let the damages accrue, and you work it up, and you wait until you know what the damages really are before you try a case. Here you're saying it's not those we want. We want the ones after a criminal charge is lodged. I'm sympathetic to your cause. I'm trying to figure it out.
It's that there aren't any damages that are actionable until they suffer severe emotional distress. They don't have a physical injury. They don't seek other treatment for which they could recover. They don't lose wages. They don't have pain and suffering until they suffer the severe emotional distress. So your instruction to the jury would be, it is the claim of the plaintiffs in this case that they suffered severe emotional distress as a result of the malpractice of Dr. Vandeleur. It is their claim that they first suffered that severe emotional distress upon learning of the criminal complaint in October 2012. You may consider whether you believe their claim, and if so, you may award them damages for the severe emotional distress that they incurred after October 2012. That's the only damage that they claim in this case. That is the only damage that we claim in this case.
So are you saying that in the action that's pending in Eau Claire County, you might have a cause of action, but you wouldn't have damages unless this cause of action goes forward?
Well, okay, first of all, there is the battery claim. That your cases are absolutely clear. You don't pay any attention to the battery claim. It's not a medical malpractice claim. You look at the medical malpractice claim. That is the claim that has been dismissed. It's the one with insurance. It's the one where there's money to compensate my clients for their injury. It's the claim we have pursued. But I will say that they didn't have a medical malpractice claim, which can't be an intentional tort. They have a medical malpractice claim at the point in time where they have actionable damages. The pattern jury instructions tells you what those damages are. That's the only claim we're asserting in this case. It is a question of fact when those damages first arose. This case is not, if I might just finish my sentence, Madam Chief Justice, this case is not new, it's not novel, it doesn't conflate anything. It's medical malpractice, injury. The only injury claim is severe emotional distress. It's a question of fact for the jury. When did the injury take place? Thank you.
I have a question for you. If we affirm the Court of Appeals, which, of course, you don't want us to do, is that the end of this entire case, or does it go back for anything?
It goes back for the unresolved question of battery against Dr. Lee.
Okay.
Because they didn't move for summary judgment, and that remains.
So now the mandate line in the Court of Appeals case, which I'm looking at the appendix here, was the order of the circuit court was affirmed. And what did that order say?
The order was given orally, and it was given in written form, and it basically said all the other claims, the direct negligence against the Mayo Clinic for failure to supervise, for negligent hiring, all of those things are gone. We haven't challenged those on appeal. The claim against sexual battery against Dr. Vandeleau remains, and the judge said the malpractice claims, which are the only ones we bring before you, are dismissed.
Okay.
If you reverse, you will reverse that decision. The only thing that will go back is the medical malpractice claim.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you all for a very interesting argument. Just when you think you understood the law and there aren't any new wrinkles, you all find wrinkles for us to think about. So thank you. The briefs were very good and very helpful, as were the oral arguments. We're going to take a brief break before we pick up our second case for this morning, so that some people can come and some people can leave, and we'll be back out again in a few minutes. Thank you so much.